Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today is our first on-air book club, which we hope will be a regular feature during the pandemic. To kick it off, we chose a book about the history of our region, written by a local author, and is also the Falmouth Town Reads Together selection for 2020. The book is Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War by Nathaniel Philbrick. Joining us is Nathaniel Philbrick. Welcome back.
Hi, great to talk with you.
Also with us is Linda Collins, director of the Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Linda.
Hi, Mindy. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Linda.
So, Linda, when we had the idea to start an on-air book club, Mayflower was suggested, and then we found out that it was the 2020 selection for Falmouth Town Reads Together. So I'm assuming you chose that because of the 400th anniversary coming up. Did that play a role in the selection?
Yes, of course. And the fact that Nate has a long history with Falmouth, I understand that you used to visit and spend summers in West Falmouth growing up, so...
Right. Yeah, no, and when I finish a book and have a bunch of the books I've used to write it, I take them to the Falmouth Library for their book sale. So it's been an ongoing relationship for a long time.
Yes, we really appreciate that. And the Friends of the Falmouth Public Library sponsor the Falmouth Reads Together every year, purchasing copies that we can make available to Falmouth residents.
Mayflower, of course, published 2006, 14 years ago. I can't believe it's been that long. So tell us where this idea came from to take a closer look at the Pilgrims' first years in the New World.
Yeah, well, I had my first work of history was a history of Nantucket, a way offshore. And that book tells the history of Nantucket through a character that takes the story of the island through a generation to the next generation and through the whaling era. And when I finished that book, I really had a sense of dissatisfaction that, you know, the native side of the story, really, the materials just weren't there. And to do justice to that side of the island's history. And so I then began work, of 4 years of work, on a book that, Abram's Eyes, which was in the Native American legacy of Nantucket. And I really focused on the oral traditions and talked to Wampanoags on the vineyard and on the Cape and really explored that whole side of things and began to realize that, you know, the true story that I was missing was the beginning, where it all began. And one of the things I had done in researching way offshore was to try to put it in the context of New England and really read for the first time with any seriousness William Bradford's of Plymouth Plantation. And, you know, I grew up being a, you know, in a pilgrim, a Thanksgiving pageant and had just the most rudimentary understanding of those traditions. And I quickly realized, you know, they did not do anywhere near the justice to the complexity of the story. And so, you know, after those two books, realized that at some point I needed to write the book that eventually became Mayflower.
Mm. One of the things I love about your books is, you know, you think you might know the history of whatever the focus is, and you always find these really interesting little tidbits that you go, wow, I didn't know that. And your research, you really dive deep to find those things. So tell us a little bit about the research that you mentioned 4 years on this book, you know, and how you uncover source material.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the frustrating thing, once again, the same problem I had with Away Offshore was in Mayflower, is, you know, so much of it is from the English perspective, but it's an extraordinarily rich archive in which there are Native voices, not, you know, through the filter of the English, obviously, but there are also different perspectives from the English. So you can get all sorts of perspectives, and what I began to do is there's not only the Pilgrim side of the story. There was Thomas Morton of Marymount in the Weymouth area who didn't like the Pilgrims and so provided a very different point of view. And so you're beginning to get, you know, all sorts of realizations that, hey, this is a very complicated story. And the other thing, all my books, I have to go to the places to really begin to see a story in any kind of richness. And so for me, this was like the story. You know, it was a local story. I thought I knew the Cape. I had spent a youth on the Cape, and you know, following the Pilgrims from Provincetown to Plymouth was an extraordinary revisiting of a place I thought I knew. And you know, one of the things I also realized was that you know, we have this idealized vision of that first Thanksgiving, always with a capital F and a capital T, and you know, where it, you know, the story ends with everyone being happy and all that kind of thing. And I realized to do justice to it, I had to follow it to the next generation, to what happened, where there was a, you know, for 50 years there was an amazingly bicultural community in Plymouth. You know, not that it was fair or anything, but it was without the warfare. But all that would change with what's known as King Philip's War, when Wampanoag.
How did things go so terribly wrong? Because it was a long time that they worked in harmony, the two cultures.
Yeah. So anyway, so all of this. So for me, it was going to the places, diving into the archives. You know, I got the chance to hold the original William Bradford's manuscript of Plymouth Plantation, which is at in the Massachusetts Archives, and you know, it's this calfskin bound document that looks like it was written 2 days ago. It's in such incredible shape, and you know, William Bradford's handwriting is unlike any other 17th century Englishman. It's actually readable, and you know, he actually printed in a way. And so, you know, it was an amazing journey for me that took me in directions I never really anticipated.
Yeah, and it's interesting because history, of course, isn't simple facts, even though it's often presented as in textbooks. But even first-person accounts of incidents are influenced by the individuals themselves, what they saw or didn't see, what their biases may be. It's there's a lot to pulling this story together, right?
Absolutely, and you know, and one of the things is this. You know, there's so many different points of view in this story. It's not just native versus English, because there was so many different subsets within both groups that it's very complicated. So I was trying to have a sense of empathy for all sides and get at the wide-ranging elements of experience. And you know, it's we like to look back to the past at a simpler time, you know, at the beginning. And I think the story of the Mayflower represents for so many Americans that beginning. And we want it to be, you know, precise and promising. And the more I looked into it, it's just not true. It was as things were just as messed up and complicated, and came from so many different perspectives as today. And so that's the hard thing about writing history is trying to channel as many of those voices as possible. But at some point, you just have to tell it, and that's what I tried to do.
I love that this is an unsanitized view of American history. It really makes you think what we've done to Thanksgiving to promote it as a very different story.
True, yeah. Listeners, we want to hear from you. Chime in with your reaction to the book or jump into the discussion with your thoughts about some of the questions we pose to our guests. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So thinking the question, you know, what was your previous understanding of the Pilgrims and their journey to North America, and how did reading Mayflower change your understanding or views of the Pilgrims? So share your thoughts with us. Linda, I'm going to put that question to you to get us started. How did reading the book change your perspective or understanding?
Well, one thing I love about this book is it's so well-researched. And, Ned, I think you enjoy the research almost as much as the writing. The book really opens your eyes to what actually happened and how we've come to remember these times, how it's been presented to us, and yet the true story, looking at both sides.
Well, you know, my process is 75% of my time is research, and I love the writing, so it gets kind of frustrating because it just takes so long to get to the point where I can begin to write. And the big challenge for me is spending all that time in the archives, reading all the variety of documents, whether it's journals, narratives, newspaper accounts, letters, all of these things, archaeological findings. The challenge is then to present it from my voice, find a voice. And for me, each book has its own voice, and it always takes a while to find it. And for this book, it was a real challenge because there are so many interwoven stories coming from so many different directions.
Tom calling from Plymouth. Good morning, Tom.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me on. I'm a big fan of Nate and Linda's and Mindy's. I'm also on the crew of the Mayflower, too.
I'm supposed
to be sailing in Boston Harbor today. But that, like so many other things, has been canceled.
Right.
So I read the book a second time. I was just actually recently reading Sarah Vowell's The Wordy Shipmates and comparing Winthrop and Bradford.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to how the pilgrims, their mutual benefit. You look at Cornhill, where you point out on page 64 that the pilgrims were experienced exiles and with a head start and an acculturation from being in Holland. And you see how both Massasoit, with his tribe decimated, and Bradford, realizing his people were in peril after abandoning the Speedwell, they really had no choice but to work together. And I think that's the beautiful part of the book. And then, of course, the second generation, the sad part of the book. So I love your reading. You love your writing. I love the book. And I'm just very excited to reread the whole book again.
Yeah. Hey, while you're on the line, can you give us an update as to Mayflower 2?
Yeah. Well, so today we were supposed to be having a late afternoon sail in the harbor. The ship is still in Mystic. We are waiting to find out if we are able to get together. Obviously, a lot of the plans for sailing to Newport and Mass Maritime Academy in Boston are all put off. As soon as we hear from Witt and the plantation where we're at, we hope to do some sails this summer. But obviously, that depends upon the state of the emergency and our ability to work in close proximity. It takes about 20 to 30 people to sail the ship.
Yeah,
and while it's less than the 104 plus on the original Mayflower, we still have to have room to work safely. So it's a sad time, but minor in comparison to all the other effects of COVID-19.
Yeah. Tom, thanks for calling and sharing that with us. We appreciate that. You're listening to The Point. It is our on-air book club. We are talking about the book Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War by Nathaniel Philbrick. Nathaniel Philbrick is with us, as is Linda Collins, director of the Falmouth Public Library. The book is the Falmouth Town Reads Together selection for 2020. We'd love to hear from you as well. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Mayflower shows us that many of the classic images that shape our current view of the pilgrims, from Plymouth Rock to, as you mentioned, our thoughts about the first Thanksgiving, have been highly fictionalized. Why has America forsaken the truth about these times in exchange for a misleading and often somewhat kind of hokey mythology?
You know, I think it does get back to this. This is, for many people, America's origin story. And people look to the Mayflower and the Pilgrims as a group of people who fled religious persecution, came to America to create a land of opportunity, and were greeted by the native peoples and had the first Thanksgiving. And you know what that ignores is that the Pilgrims, yes, they fled religious persecution, but that didn't mean they came to America to found a religious free community. Quite the opposite. They were closer to, I think, a cult than many of us realize. And what their intentions were to create, their way was the right way, and they didn't tolerate other ways. When, for example, Quakers would come to New England, result in some of them getting hanged on Boston Common. And so, you know, that was one side of it. And the other side of it is, you know, the sense of what left out is the horrifying circumstances that the Native American community had been through in the 3 years preceding the arrival of the English. The European spawned diseases, you know, and I think now is the time that I can relate, you know, I think we can all relate to this in a way and with an intimacy that I didn't necessarily feel 14 years ago when this book was published, is, you know, how terrifying a pandemic is. And, you know, we haven't experienced anything close to what was happening in what we call New England in the 3 years preceding the arrival of the English. Imagine a pandemic in which 80% of the people die. Where the Pilgrims settled in what they called Plymouth had been Patuxent, a community of 2,000 people. There was no one there when the Pilgrims arrived. The white and bones of the dead could still be seen on the ground. And so, you know, this was the circumstance of this new beginning for the English. And it was it's sobering, and it's a necessary fact that needs to be understood, I think, if we're going to begin to look at the circumstances of America's beginning with any sense of justice to what happened at that starting point.
Yeah. Kathy is giving us a call from Falmouth. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for letting me talk with you. I am fairly new to the Cape. This is just my second year living in Falmouth. But I was very interested in reading your book, Nathaniel, because I am a descendant of one of the Mayflower's indentured servants. I am descended from Edward Doty.
Uh-huh.
And so I wanted to see, as I was reading, if you'd have any information about him, and you actually did, about how he had a duel with the other indentured servant. They were servants to Stephen Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a duel or something, and so their head and feet were tied together, and they were put out in the main road in the town of Plymouth. So I thought, that's interesting, because I had visited a year ago when I first moved here. I went to Plymouth Plantation, and I had my granddaughter with me, who was just 12 at the time. Mm-hmm. And we went up to Stephen Hopkins' house. You know, they reenact, which mm-hmm. I wasn't aware of. I didn't realize they put themselves in time.
Yeah.
And they don't know anything about our present time. They just are in 1620 to 1625. So we were talking to Stephen Hopkins, and my granddaughter said, "Do you know Edward Doty?" And he said, "I sure do. He was, you know, one of my servants, and he was very bad. We had to discipline him." And my granddaughter's eyes got so big, like, what? He was real? She had no idea, you know, that this was a real story. But I thought that Plymouth Plantation does a very good job of trying to stay in character. And I wanted to know about your perception. I know you're talking about in your book, which I really found fascinating, how you could go into all the research and really tell us more about what was happening with the Native Americans at the time. I think that their Wampanoag, whatever they call their village that's right next to Plymouth Plantation, I think they do a very good job of explaining what their lives, you know, were like right then at that time. But I really appreciate all the research that you did in your book to give us more information. But I had one question. I don't believe that in the Wampanoag village, I believe all of them called themselves Native Americans. And I noticed that you interchange Indian with Native American a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, it's the terminology. There are some Native Americans that want the term Indian and vice versa. And so I used both terms, and as much to create variety in the narrative as anything. And I have to say, in a way, this book began when I was a chaperone with my daughter's second grade class trip to Plymouth Plantation, because they do an incredible job of providing a dramatic and real perspective for young people, particularly. That can be so impressionable, and that's really the only way to deliver history is emotionally. And and so I think they do a wonderful job.
Yeah, Kathy, thanks for sharing. Appreciate you calling in. We have an email from Linda from Falmouth. She says, I was struck by Philbrick's use of the word racism for the intolerance of various groups toward Native people. Of course, it was racism, but I don't know that I termed it as such before reading this book. Linda, thank you for sharing with us. Karen is calling from Falmouth. Hi, Karen.
Good morning, Mindy, and thank you for taking my call. I have a question. Hopefully it's not a complicated question for Mr. Philbrick. And it's a pleasure to speak to you, sir.
Oh, good to see you.
And you mentioned complicated times then and now. In a sense, that way, things have not changed much in 400 years. But obviously, the times dictated the Pilgrims' actions. And I'm wondering, do you find any contradictions to the Pilgrims, to their way of living at that time?
Well, you know, there are, in terms of different accounts.
Just as a people.
Let's get him back. Hang on, Karen, for the answer to your question. Did you enjoy the book, Karen?
I did. And in fact, I've gone back to it several times. So I appreciate Mr. Philbrick's research. It's that ethic is very admirable.
Yeah. And hang on, Karen. Linda, let me ask you, what was the response when the book was chosen for, you know, it's not an easy read. It's a pretty good sized book. Where I imagine right now people are happy to have that distraction.
Have a long book to read. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Falmouth Reads Together tries to alternate fiction and nonfiction. And so last year we read The Little Prince, which was a pretty brief read, although interesting book in its own right. But The Mayflower was well received because of the time people were thinking about the 400th celebration. Mm-hmm. It's been challenging to get the book out to people from the library, but we've made sure that there are plenty of electronic copies available if people want to read it in that way. So
yeah.
Yes, it was very well received.
Yeah. All right. We lost you there for a minute.
I'm back. Sorry.
Okay. That's okay. Go ahead. You were answering Karen's question, I think. Yeah.
Right.
Right. And could you remind me what question I was answering?
Yeah. So the times obviously dictated the Pilgrims' actions, but did you find them as a people of contradiction?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because they lived in their time, and one of the things that defined them were their spiritual beliefs. And the most important thing for them was their congregation, the covenant they had among each other in their attempts to live God's will, and. You know, they looked to America as a kind of blank slate where they could do their thing. And what they found was it wasn't a blank slate. There were other people here. It was a very complicated situation rather than what they had been looking for was this place where they could go be by themselves and fulfill their spiritual ambitions. And so there is an inherent contradiction because here their main motivation was to fulfill themselves spiritually when suddenly they were thrown into this situation about which they could have had no understanding beforehand, and they had to deal with another people about which they initially knew nothing and about which they would remain in the dark in many ways. And so their whole lives were a contradiction in a way in which they were here for one purpose. And yet circumstances changed everything. And what I find most interesting is it's the contradictions that would take them out of being that simply that spiritual religious cult and become what would eventually be Americans, people who had to deal with others, a dynamic and diverse situation that created a whole new identity for them. And you know, it's in some cases a story of uplift, but for me, it's also, when you look to the next generation, it's a story of opportunity lost, as you see the second generation forgetting the debt they owed to the native peoples that made their existence possible.
Yeah, Karen, thanks for the question. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Matthew is calling from Springfield. Hi, Matthew.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, go ahead.
This is kind of a loaded question, but because of books like Mayflower, most fairly educated people have hopefully come to know or at least admit the true story of the Pilgrims landing here. And all the atrocities that kind of ensued. But would you say that we've come full circle and that time has been somewhat unfair to the separatists?
Yeah, as I was saying earlier, I had great sympathy for all sides in this complicated story. And, and I was trying to see everyone's perspective. And, it's easy for us now to look back and say, you know, what were they thinking when, you know, they encountered the native inhabitants of a region and initially, you know, fired their muskets at them and stole their corn and things like that. And on the other side, they really didn't, they were terrified and they it was a terribly planned voyage. They were running out of food even before they arrived in America. And so somehow they made it happen. I was talking about the plagues that had taken so many of the native peoples. The pilgrims in that first winter would lose half of their community to disease. So they were dealing with, you know, entire families were lost during that first year, and I think something like four orphans came out of those months, terrible months of loss. And so, you know, they had, I have sympathy for that too. And yet, I think it's also important to realize that even their own minister back in Holland, John Robinson, and that's for me the great what if. He was their spiritual leader. He was in many ways the reason why they attempted this voyage. And you know, he stayed back because only a percentage of them could come over. He stayed with the rest and was planning to come, but he never did. But when, you know, they would write him letters of, you know, they had this, I don't know if readers might remember the sort of punitive expedition against the Massachusetts Indians at Wessagusset, in which Miles Standish leads basically a commando attack and comes back with the head of one of the warriors. And when Governor William Bradford writes to John Robinson back in Leiden about this, he's not happy with them. He says, you know, it would be better that, you know, you reached out in love rather than hate. I'm paraphrasing here. And so, you know, I think you see within their own community some sense of disappointment and judgment. And, you know, hey, this is life in the world today and then. It's, you know, no one goes through, you know, exactly knowing what they're doing. It's confusion. It's just trying to do the best under the circumstances, and it's never enough. But that's that defines the human experience. And what I was trying to do with Mayflower was to make these people rather mm-hmm. than the archetypes, that have developed.
Yeah, Matthew, thanks for joining the conversation. We appreciate that. Lynn is calling from Plymouth. Hi, Lynn.
Hello, and thank you for having this opportunity. I've read the Mayflower twice now, and each time I learn new things. But I wanted to go back to the some of the earlier comments that kind of paralleled what we are now currently facing with the COVID pandemic. Mm-hmm. And thinking about how decimated the Indian population had been when the Pilgrims arrived. I'm curious to know if Mr. Philbrook thinks that if the fact that Massasoit's people had been destroyed, did that impact how the Pilgrims were assisted when they first arrived?
Well, you know, this is a political story in many ways. You know, on the Native side, there were many different tribes, and Massasoit led the Poconokets, based in Narragansett Bay, and their greatest rivals were the Narragansett on the other side of the bay. And these diseases decimated Massasoit's people, you know, in many ways, clear-cut a lot of them, so that he was and did not touch the rival Narragansetts, and forcing Massasoit to submit to the Narragansett. And so he was a proud leader, looking out for his people. And when the Pilgrims arrived, he was initially, the evidence we have is he wasn't quite sure how to deal with this situation. This is new. These were not fishermen, you know, on the coast for a few months and leaving. These were not explorers creating a trading outpost and then leaving. These were people here to stay. And there's evidence that he really sort of studied the situation, watched what was happening to the English throughout that terrible winter, and made the calculated decision to try to create an alliance with these people. They had a different technology and all that as a potential way of giving his tribe a kind of parity relative to the Narragansett. And so it was without that, there's no doubt that the Pilgrim settlement would have not made it through. They were desperate. They were, you know, but with the Poconokets' help, the Pilgrims were able to survive that summer. They learned the native ways of agriculture, and thus it went. And so, the book tells the complicated story that then unfolds, where, you know, tribe against tribe, not all of other tribes were on were with Massasoit in this, but things would work themselves out, and that it would create a lasting alliance that would exist for another 50 years.
We are discussing the book Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War, with us author Nathaniel Philbrook and Linda Collins, director of the Falmouth Public Library. 866-999-4626 is our number, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Patricia writes, have teachers used Mayflower instead of textbooks, or has your book forced any textbook companies to make changes to the point of view on how these chapters of history are written? Do we know? I don't know if we know the answer to that, do we?
No, you know, it's been really interesting. You know, this book came out a while ago, and I'm getting old enough now that I'll run into graduate students of history who I was in Charleston actually doing research on my next book, and there was a woman at the microfilm and said she was getting her PhD in history at University of Massachusetts, and said, I read Mayflower and I was assigned in high school, and it was interesting to hear that. It's one of the great delights is to have a chance to talk with young people who have read the book, and get their take on those kinds of things. You know, history is something. It's a story. For me, the past is only alive if it's something you can connect with emotionally as well as intellectually. And and I think, you know, the great challenge. I know, growing up for me, the great challenge was history often seems so boring. And it's when I read Johnny Tremaine, it was like, oh, the back of my head blew off because there was a kid just like me who was in the middle of the Revolution. And there is a, when it comes to Mayflower, there is a young adult version of it, which was a lot harder to put together than I initially realized, but I'm very proud of it. And it's a book that's used in middle schools, and I think does justice to the story and all its complexity. And I know, you know, there's quite a few teachers have used it.
Yeah. Linda, what are your thoughts on that? I imagine, you know, being in the library, you must get inquiries about different perspectives from students anyway, if not teachers.
Well, we work closely with the schools and their summer reading list, and Mayflower is on the summer reading list for the high school, and we also have copies of the young adult version. So, yes, it's very popular in Falmouth and being used in the schools.
Yeah. I talked to Tor, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Tor.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
I read the book as part of the Falmouth Read several months ago and was looking forward to the discussion groups that are always part of that, so I'm so glad you're doing this today. I always appreciate Mr. Philbrick's detail, especially with just the day-to-day life for this period. And what's something that struck me as a backpacker and hiker and knowing the logistics and planning we go through just for, you know, a hike of several days, I was struck by the distances that people cover just routinely for, it seemed like, day-to-day errands or communication, and just how much of their life that must have taken up, and yet they seem to do it almost at the drop of a hat. And that's just a comment.
Yeah, no, it is one of those amazing things where you look, you know, they're walking from Plymouth to what's now Barrington, and you know, it takes them a day and a half, and it's, you know, they don't have horses yet in the colony, things like that, and you know, so it's so much of our sense of travel. You just throw that out the window, and you know, and this is why things like rivers and canoes and water travel were so important because of these distances. But it did not prevent the Cape and southern New England from being completely connected in all sorts of ways. You know, all of those. Route 1 and all those other roads were, you know, originally native trails that that you see the English using then, and so it's for me, this is where visiting the places was so instructive, and suddenly this, if you're on a highway, you miss the whole sense of that. If you get off the highway and begin to, you know, follow the rivers and all of those old initial roads, you begin to get a sense of the land that was much more a part of their understanding than it is for us today.
Yeah. Tor, thanks for bringing that up. That was a good point. Matt writes, do you think that Massasoit manipulated Homer and the Pilgrims into a preemptive strike on the Wiggisucket for his own political gain?
I think Massasoit was a very sophisticated leader in a tight spot, and I think his advice to the Pilgrims at this point was calculated to eliminate a rival. I mean, what was happening was that he had sided with the Pilgrims, but many of the peoples who were aligned with him did not agree with that move, and by directing the Pilgrims to make a strike, that eliminated one of his rivals, and in fact sent a message throughout the region that solidified his leadership. He would be uncontested for the next 50 years, and his sons as the leader of the people we now call the Wampanoag. And I think that strike created that. You know, and you know, the Pilgrims kind of think of themselves as the major players in their own destiny, when in many ways I think they were pawns being moved by Massasoit.
Marjorie is giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Marjorie.
There. I just wanted to say that I live in East Falmouth, and I go to the East Falmouth Library Book Club, and our book was The Mayflower for the month just before we all were confined to home.
Oh, yeah.
I read it with great enjoyment, and I think the thing that struck me the most was that the pilgrims just didn't seem to expect to find an active nation already here with all the different factions and ways of life. And they didn't try to understand the value of that way of life. They just wanted it to be their way and no other. Mm-hmm. To me, this created the many difficulties through all the generations up until today. This is my biggest take from the book, which I loved.
Well,
thank you.
Well, thanks. You know, it's definitely, you know, what happened in this part of New England created the template of what would happen with America's March West. You know, a lot of people ask me, you know, the book I would write after Mayflower is The Last Stand, about the Battle of Little Bighorn. And a lot of people said, well, why the heck would you do that? Well, it was because I finished Mayflower, where my take on the beginning of America is, you know, this potential promise leading to this terrible Native English conflict. And I said, well, if that's an archetypal beginning, what's the archetypal end? And for me, you know, I thought, well, it's got to be Custer's Last Stand. And what also attracted me about that after the experience of researching and writing Mayflower was that the Custer's end is only known to us through the Native accounts, because no one survived from Custer's the companies on Last Stand Hill. And so for me, that was a way to come to terms with and explore American history under the terms kind of set forth by the English Native contact in New England in the 17th century.
Marjorie, thanks for the phone call. Marguerite is calling from Brewster. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning to everyone. And Mr. Philbrick, thank you so much for your book. I was certified K through 6 several years ago, and I just retired a couple of years ago after 20 years in the Brewster schools. I worked mostly with third graders, and the third grade curriculum in Massachusetts, social studies curriculum, covers the history of Massachusetts from the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag all the way through the Revolution. We had a textbook that was a beautiful textbook. It was full of maps and photographs and history and personalities. It did cover both the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag. The Wampanoag got their own chapter, in fact. And early on, what I saw the kids doing with just a book in front of them was they'd be dropping like flies. Their hands would be raised. Can I go to the bathroom? Can I sharpen my pencil? Like that. So I made it my job early on to turn what they were supposed to learn into hands-on activities. Now, this is a plug for your book, Mr. Philbrick, to teachers. Take the book that's been rewritten for younger children. Take the absolutely most concrete examples of the way the Wampanoags and the Pilgrims lived and turn them into hands-on lessons, because we did that in Brewster, and the kids loved it. They lapped it up. Thank you again.
Yeah, Margaret, that's a great suggestion. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, no, and it's my mother was a kindergarten teacher, and my mother-in-law was a librarian in the Falmouth public school systems, and you know, so when I hear from teachers and librarians, you guys are in the front line, and I just feel like these are my people.
Exactly. All right, let's talk to Fritz, who's calling from Katuit. Hi, Fritz.
Hi. I just wanted to hear a mention about Squantos and the complications of his position, but I think that's too long of a question. And
maybe you can give a quick answer. About,
this is Squanto?
Yeah, Squanto.
Yeah. Well, you know, he is one of the more fascinating characters, I think, in this. I mean, he is someone who had, he had been abducted, spent 3 years in England, in Spain. He understood where the English were coming from, and then comes back, which is just, can you imagine this mind-blowing experience of going over there? And then he comes back 3 years later to discover his home of Patuxent, now Plymouth, there's no one left. There's no village there. And so this guy has been through all of this, and he ends up, and he's mistrusted by Massasoit. Who is this guy? What? Where's he coming from? But he is the only one who knows English, and he becomes the interpreter. And you see this not just with Squanto, but in other interpreters throughout American history. They're in a unique position where they are the conduit of information and can manipulate how that information is exchanged. And you see Squanto, manipulating that exchange, and even attempting to manipulate Massasoit to the point that it angers Massasoit to the point where he orders Bradford to turn him over to be executed. Bradford can't bear to do that, but eventually Squanto dies of a disease. I in what's now Chatham. I posit the possibility he may have been poisoned. We will never know, but he is a fascinating character, and if you can look from his perspective, he was the only, he understood what, the world that the English had come from and what was in store for the native peoples of the region. And, he may have thought of, I've got to be the leader because I'm the only one who understands what's going to happen here. Someone like Massasoit saw him as calculating, trying to undermine him and seize power on his own. And, here we see the complexity of this story.
Yeah. But a quick email before we have to wrap this up. This is from Mary. She says, this book addresses the loss of a sense of and dedication to community as the years between arrival in 1620 and 1660, where settlers grew to focus their efforts on their own individual gain over the advancement of the community, and how this affected the history of New England. This seems to me to be a thread throughout our history, the tension between providing for societal needs and the individual's rights to ownership, accumulation of wealth, and reluctance to support others through government action. Mary, thank you for sharing your thoughts. We will post links with more information about Mayflower and all of Nathaniel Philbrick's books, along with more information about Falmouth Reads Together at our website, capeandislands.org. Nathaniel Philbrick, author of Mayflower and so many other good books, thank you for being with us this morning.
Oh, thank you, Mindy. It has been so much fun, and I appreciate everyone for taking the time to read Mayflower. It means a lot.
Right. And Linda Collins, director of the Falmouth Public Library, thank you for being with us this morning as well.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much, Nate.
We'll have another book club program scheduled for July 1st. The book will be the novella titled Lady Into Fox by David Gannett. We'll post details at our website how you can get a copy. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.